Okay, so our anchor leg today is a great hepatologist who has, I've learned a lot of liver pathology and biology from over the last 10 years or so since hepatitis C has really come to the forefront. And it's Dr. Ken Sherman from University of Cincinnati, who's a professor there and division director in gastroenterology, hepatology. He's going to talk to us about issues in liver health and disease for the non-hepatologist, and I think you'll find it a great way to in the today's session. So welcome, Ken.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here. So this was a pretty open topic, like the whole world of hepatology. And so I decided to focus on, first, who is the audience, and then what might they be interested in. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about is related to sort of hot topic issues in viral hepatitis. I'm not going to talk much about hep C. I have a workshop on that later, and there's a lecture on that with David Thomas from Johns Hopkins tomorrow. So, but we'll hit some areas of viral hepatitis and then finish up with NASH. Here's my disclosures and the learning objectives. We'll start with a question. A 40-year-old homeless man with HIV presents to the emergency department with mental status changes. On physical exam, he appears to be a malnourished man. He has icteric sclera, abdominal tenderness in the right upper quadrant on palpation, and asterixis is present. Which of the following is most likely? So your choices are acute hepatitis A, acute hepatitis B, decompensated chronic B, decompensated chronic C, hepatitis D superinfection, or acute hepatitis E. Go ahead and vote. Okay, so that's perfect, because that was exactly what I thought was going to happen. First, this is the kind of test you want if you ever have to take a board exam, because every answer is right. So you can all feel good about yourselves. The correct answer in this particular patient was acute hepatitis A, and we'll talk about that in a few moments. But certainly acute hep B is a possibility. Decompensated B, we don't know enough about this patient's history to know whether they could have had chronic B or C, and they could present that way. Hepatitis D, superinfection, and acute hepatitis E are both emerging disease processes that have been poorly recognized, often missed, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to do this talk today. So if we think about the history of the evolution of liver injury in those with HIV, we've gone through various phases. We've seen in the 90s the introduction of the combination antiretroviral therapies leading to emergence of chronic liver diseases with advanced fibrosis and cirrhosis as being an important issue due to chronic viral infections. We went through periods where drug-associated liver injury was a big issue, less so nowadays. And what we're seeing in the last 5 to 7 years is rising rates of liver disease associated with NASH or NAFLD. We'll talk some more about that. We're seeing emergence of hepatitis E. We're rediscovering hepatitis D. And the big surprise on the list that we sort of had thought we had put behind us was hepatitis A, but hepatitis A has become huge in the last couple of years. So that's why these are the topics, changing epi and new concerns. We're going to talk a little bit about a hep B new vaccine and then talk a little bit about NAFLD and NASH. So for hepatitis A, as I said, it looked like it was just about done. We weren't hearing much about it. Occasionally, in my clinic, we would see a case. I reported a couple of index cases to local health departments over the years, and in general, they weren't that interested in following up on them or doing much of anything. But that really changed in the last couple of years, and as of October, the CDC reported over 7,000 cases, up from 2,000 for years before that, and with the understanding that that represents the tip of the iceberg, maybe someplace between 40% or up to 100 times more cases than that are actually occurring. There's also been a series of reports about significant increases in Hep A seen in European cities among men who have sex with men. So this is what the headlines look like. If you look since 2016, we see that there's all of these different things. There's a catfish restaurant in Jonesboro, Arkansas, and scallops in Hawaii, and frozen strawberries. And in my area, there's been a bunch of fast food outlets that recently have showed up with hepatitis A. And there was a sushi restaurant in Hawaii that was associated with hundreds and hundreds of cases. And even smoothies, something as benign as a smoothie associated with hepatitis A infection, leading the CDC to generate a map of hotspots with recent reporting. All of the darker shaded areas, this all started in California, in San Diego area, and most of you probably heard about that. There was a spread north to Los Angeles and to other counties in California. There were associated cases described in Nevada, in Utah, and Arizona. But separately, the emergence of huge outbreaks across the midsection of the country, some recent ones in New England. In my area, we are now seeing, I come from Ohio, and we're seeing 1 to 2 cases of fulminant hepatic failure a week admitted to the hospital in the last 2 to 3 months. So huge numbers of cases, because that's only the tip of the iceberg. So the clinical presentations that patients have, this is the typical list. In fact, this is the list that's in a book chapter I wrote about this. But asymptomatic disease without jaundice is a little bit of a misnomer, because a lot of the patients actually have sort of vague gastroenteritis symptoms. Oh, my stomach was kind of hurting, and I had nausea and vomiting, and I had fatigue that wouldn't go away, and it lasted for several weeks, and no one did the testing because no one knew that they were jaundiced, so no one ever thought that this is something that should have been evaluated or reported. Once there's actually an outbreak reported through the local news media in a given part of the country, all of a sudden these individual cases come to the forefront because more people go and seek care. And when you hear about those things, these are what you should be thinking about. There is the symptomatic, self-limited illness with jaundice. But remember, patients don't, and their families, don't see jaundice until bilirubin is greater than 10. It was actually studied in a systematic manner about 25 years ago, and most people can't see jaundice. So your bilirubin has to get quite high before you realize that you're jaundiced and seek medical care. That's why a lot of these cases end up being called these cases. There is a persistent form of cholestatic jaundice lasting more than 10 weeks. There's this unusual relapsing acute hepatitis with two or more instances over a 10-week period. We've documented two of these in my health system in the last 4 weeks or so, one of them in an HIV-positive patient. And we have access to assays that are not routinely clinically available, including PCR amplification of hepatitis A. And we're able to show that over a period of 2 months, these patients continue to have elevated liver enzymes or flares of liver enzymes with persistent hepatitis A infection. And then the patients presenting with acute hepatic failure, similar to the case that I described to you. Once a patient develops signs of encephalopathy, confusion, that's acute hepatic failure. Okay. Hepatitis B. We have the first new vaccine in more than 20 years was approved by the FDA within the last year. It's called Heplisav-B. It contains CpG-1019, which is a TLR9 agonist, and it improves the immune responses such that in immunocompetent populations, only a two-dose regimen is needed to have effective protective immunity. Three doses were studied in those with chronic kidney disease who are immunosuppressed such that they don't mount typical responses. There are no data at this point in HIV-infected persons. Why does the two-dose matter? Well, this is a recent publication from a study of 500,000 individuals routinely, adults, routinely prescribed hepatitis B vaccine series. And they looked at how long or how many actually completed the typical three-shot vaccine series. And so this is the second dose 1 month after, within 1 month of when they should have received the second dose, and it was just over 30%. And if you waited for that second dose out to 13 months, more than a year from the start of the vaccination series, the total proportion vaccinated only went to 50%. And then if you said, how many actually completed the three-dose series going out 28 months, it was back to around 30%. So we, as a community of healthcare providers, are not very good at giving patients three doses of Hep B vaccine, or at least adult patients of three doses of vaccine, which is one of the reasons that having a two-dose option is promising. Maybe we'll get up to effective vaccination at least 50% if we continue to follow those bad practices. This is the Heplisav-B. Three pivotal trials were done. They were younger patients, 18 to 55, what they called older patients, 40 to 70, and then a large group of mixed ages, but also a group containing patients with diabetes, which also don't respond as well to vaccines, including hepatitis B vaccine. This, anything north of this line is better. It favors the Heplisav-B, and in all of those studies, there was efficacy. There was no significant safety signals that were seen. So this drug or this vaccination series was approved by the FDA. In the diabetes patients, it achieved a better response than the Engerix-B, the previous standard dose, or the standard vaccination type. And in dialysis patients, it achieved both the non-inferiority measure that was the way the study was designed to prove, but it actually achieved superiority in a number of key vaccine response parameters. So we don't know yet about HIV. The ACTG will be doing a study looking at two or three doses versus Engerix-B. And if you have access as we get into the new year to ACTG sites to refer patients to. Please think about sending adult patients who either have never, with HIV, who have never been treated previously, or those who did not respond to a first series of vaccine, because those both groups will be studied in the trial. Here's your next ARS question. A 52-year-old man with HBV-HIV co-infection is seen in follow-up. He complains of increasing abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting. His urine has become dark in color. He reports unprotected sex with men and women. He was recently switched from a two-drug regimen of dolutegravir, lamivudine, from a previously stable regimen with good suppression of raltegravir, tenofovir, and tracitabine. He had been on that for about 5 years, good suppression, but the provider taking care of that patient was reading some of the studies, particularly those coming out of Europe, and said, wow, we can simplify your regimen and give you a two-drug regimen because you've been so stable. You are most concerned now about which one of these: drug hepatotoxicity, acute HCV infection, acute renal failure, hepatitis B flare, or hepatitis D superinfection. Go ahead and vote. Okay. So you are all rock stars. And remember the lessons from the past. Drug hepatotoxicity is unlikely with this regimen. This could be acute hep C. He certainly has risk factors, and you would want to investigate that. There's no reason to think this is acute renal failure. Hep B flare is highly likely. And again, because we always forget about hep D, and he has hep B, it could be hep D. And so that probably should have gotten a few more votes from some people in the audience. But this is the key lesson that maybe most of you remembered. This is one of the early studies that I was involved with on virus breakthrough. This was in the days when we had been using lamivudine for a few years. We put together a series with Dr. Bessison at University of Colorado, looking at patients who had been on stable regimens and then all of a sudden had what looked like an acute hepatitis. And it turned out that those were flares of hep B due to emergence of YMDD motif mutations associated with the use of lamivudine, which has a relatively low barrier to resistance. So many of those patients are still out there, patients that are carrying mutations that are LAM-resistant in their hep B and have been largely suppressed, but they haven't gone away. Those are sort of part of what they're holding on to with their chronic hepatitis B infection, which has been largely suppressed on regimens containing tenofovir over the years. And when we take tenofovir off, all of a sudden we see a flare. And we've actually seen two of these cases in the last 4 months or so. So people are indeed looking at regimen simplification and sort of forgetting about the hepatitis B. So remember, if your patient has hep B, don't stop a hep B active agent, which means probably keeping them on TAF or tenofovir. Okay, hepatitis D, I've mentioned that a few times, and it is associated with increased liver disease severity in the settings of both superinfection and co-infection with hepatitis B. There's more rapid rates of disease progression and early cirrhosis. There is increased risk of hepatocellular carcinoma in those that get hep D. Remember that even a patient with chronic hep B HIV who is suppressed for the hep B on a regimen containing a form of tenofovir, for example, is still producing surface antigen. This virus is not suppressed by tenofovir. It's an RNA virus, and so all it needs is the surface antigen that's available to be able to perpetuate its replication scheme and cause an acute superinfection in those patients. The geographic distribution is shown here. We are considered in the low area, as is most of Europe and other parts of the world, shown in green. Though, in fact, there have not been that many surveys looking at what low is. There was a paper a few years ago from San Diego where the rate in all comers with chronic hepatitis B was over 8%. So that is not low. That's actually similar to the high prevalence areas in the world, suggesting there are places or pockets perhaps in the U.S. where high rates are common. The guidelines of management are in the U.S. focused on the idea that the rates are low, and this is exceedingly uncommon. And the only real guideline in the U.S. comes from the AASLD, where it says that that laboratory tests for someone who's HBsAg positive should include assessment of liver disease, markers of replication, tests for co-infection with HCV, HDV, or HIV in those at risk, which includes individuals from HDV endemic areas and those with a history of injection drug use. So sort of, well, that's not going to be most of your patients. That's the common thinking, so let's not really worry about it. In Europe, the European guidelines say all patients should be considered to be evaluated for Hep D, and the Asian Pacific guidelines say the same thing. So I live in Ohio, as I already told you, sort of the Midwest. How much Hep D could there be in the Midwest, and how good are we doing at looking at it? So we recently did a study to begin to ask the question, is it there and are we looking for it? We identified 1,007 Hep B surface antigen positive patients. Among those, 15.4% or 155 had co-infection with HIV. And 852 were HIV negative. So first thing that tells you, Hep B is common in the heartland, even though lots of people don't think about it as a common disease. We then asked the question, was there testing? 113 of the HBV mono-infected patients in our healthcare system had been tested, but among those with HIV, only 8 had been tested, or 5.1%. And in that, those 8 patients, none of them turned out to have hepatitis D. But in the other group, where a higher proportion were tested, it was actually 3.3%. When we asked who did the testing, it was very interesting. The gastroenterologists and hepatologists most frequently tested, followed by general internists. The infectious disease docs never tested for this. And so that's one of the reasons I thought this is a hot topic issue, is this is something we should be thinking of and evaluating for. So HDV testing is rarely performed. Patients with HIV are less likely to have been tested. The gastroenterologists and hepatologists are more likely to order it. The rate of HDV positivity when we apply a 95% confidence interval was 0.9 to 8.2%. So, you know, you could argue on either sides of that range, but once you get over 2% in a population, the CDC generally recommends screening in that population. We need to do better. Okay, in the last 5 minutes or so, we're going to talk about fatty liver. So first, what is NAFLD? Or if you are a millennial, they're all calling it NAFLD now. The name sort of abruptly changed in the last 2 years. You have to start with, what is fatty liver? So fatty liver is a liver that has more than 5% of the hepatocytes have fat in them, or steatosis. And then you have to say, what is the cause of that? Because there is non-alcoholic fatty liver, and then there is alcoholic fatty liver. And in truth, we don't know the threshold for alcohol giving you a fatty liver. So in the purest sense of this, you would say a person who has fatty liver is a person who doesn't drink and appears to have fat on their liver by some test modality. But in reality, the epidemiologic studies have settled on 20 grams a week, which is just about 2.5 or 3 drinks a day for patients. And anything less than that, you would call NAFL, or perhaps we'll get to NASH in a moment. And above that, it must be alcoholic fatty liver. But again, we really don't know an exact line of where that is. We do know that if you come to big convention center like this one, and when this long day ends, you go to the bar and you do that 2 days in a row, and you have more than 4 drinks, you will have a fatty liver for the next week or so, even if you stop drinking, and then that will resolve. So then what makes it a disease? Well, if there's injury associated with it, it's a disease. It's not just steatosis or fatty liver. So NAFLD is generally characterized by an elevated ALT level as a marker of liver injury. There's a continuum of disease. You have steatosis or fat. Fat by itself is not really a disease. Liver enzymes elevated are a disease. And when you get certain criteria and characteristics met, we begin to call that injury NASH, or non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. Why do we distinguish? Because NAFLD left untouched, not reaching that stage of what we call NASH, doesn't seem to directly progress to cirrhosis, but NASH does progress to cirrhosis. How often does it progress? Well, the current thinking is that between 9 and 20% of cases will go on to cirrhosis within some number of years, 10, 15 years, and will lead to a 22 to 33% liver-related death in that population. And another 8 to 10% of those patients will develop a liver cancer within 7 years. So fatty liver injury can cause liver cancer. You can prevent cancer by preventing that injury. Liver transplant trends show that NASH, this line here, is continuously rising. We're finally seeing a drop in Hep C-associated need for transplantation, but it's simply being replaced by patients with fatty liver with NASH-associated cirrhosis. In those with HIV, the prevalence of NASH runs from 20 to over 50% of patients in various series that have been surveyed. So this is a common disease in your patients that you often don't know about. The risk factors, there are many in those with HIV, but certainly obesity, the complex interactions of HIV medicines being associated with a situation where we get oxidative stress in the liver associated with hormonal disturbances can create this cycle of steatosis to NASH and leading to cirrhosis. Obesity, big factor, and we clearly see more of it in these states. The states that are red or orange for many reasons. So, What should you be doing? Well, your clinical suspicion should start with one of two things, either abnormal liver enzymes, even low-level abnormal liver enzymes, because and I've said this at this meeting in prior years when I've been here, a normal ALT for a man is 30, regardless of what your lab tells you is normal, and for a woman is 19. If levels are above that, your patient probably has a liver disease. If there's imaging suggesting fat in the liver, that doesn't mean there is fat in the liver, by the way, because radiologists call anything echogenic could be fat in the liver, as well as 12 other things. So you need laboratory tests to begin to rule out other causes of liver disease. You can calculate from simple lab tests, FIB4 or APRI. Didn't put on this FibroScan or transient elastography because not everyone has that available to them. But if you suspect the patient has significant fibrosis, they need additional evaluation and perhaps referral to a hepatologist and the consideration at least of whether they should have a liver biopsy. Certainly, if they have clear evidence of fat as determined by CAP, which is an associated test on transient elastography, you're probably dealing with a fatty liver, and if the liver enzymes are elevated, at least NAFLD or possibly NASH. So it's time we started looking for this. This is going to be the next big, big problem in our patient population. There's a variety of targets that are being studied. I don't have time to go into those now, but it's important to note we have no really effective drugs at this point for NASH, except for high dose 800 units of vitamin E, which was shown in a great trial to be effective in some patients. But other than that, we don't have anything. We probably will in late 2019, early 2020. So stay tuned, because in the not too distant future, you're going to be hearing about drugs for your patients for this disease process. In conclusion, liver disease remains an important consideration for those with or without HIV infection in your practices. Viral infections that were rare have become quite common again. Changes in ART management require awareness of the co-infections that may be underlying, and NAFLD and NASH are coming. Be ready for it. Thank you.
Thank you. So we need about 8 minutes on the clock there, 5 minutes. Okay. So I got several. We can just do rapid-fire questions here. Post-vaccination immunity greater than 10 for HBV, is that immunity for life? Go ahead.
No.
All right, so no. So, all right, we can just do it here if you want.
All right. Okay, that was easy.
No, those patients will get infected if they fall below 10. If you're infected, you incorporate something called CCC DNA. You have an increased risk of malignancy and of recrudescent disease.
Real quickly about hepatitis D, we didn't talk about that so as much, but what do you do if you have a hepatitis D antibody in an HBV-positive patient?
So that patient is at even higher risk of developing hepatocellular carcinoma. The antibody would give you the presumption that patient is positive. If you can access from some of the national labs an HDV RNA, that will confirm that, though you don't really need that to be extra vigilant in that patient in terms of HCC screening. Unfortunately, we have no hepatitis D meds at this time that are effective. There are several agents under study.
Right. And related, who do you draw an HDV antibody in? Anybody with Hep B?
I think at this point it should be any HBsAg positive patient should be tested at least once for Hep D, and if they have ongoing risk factors, just like we do for other viral infections, retest at some interval that's not defined.
do you give a hepatitis B vaccine to somebody who's core antibody positive but surface antigen and surface antibody negative?
That is one approach to those patients. In my practice, we test them for HBV DNA first to find out if they have occult hep B. That is more common in those with HIV infection. But patients do lose the antibody and will respond to a single booster dose. And you can do it that way as well, test 30 days after the booster dose.
Okay. How do you counsel people with NASH? What do you tell them to do, not to do?
Lose weight. Don't drink alcohol.
Exercise.
Exercise is effective in some patients. If they're morbidly obese, there are actually pretty good studies showing that that bariatric surgery is quite effective.
Any role for fenofibrate or a vitamin E?
Yes, the vitamin E, 800 units daily, is an effective regimen in some patients, and you should see a decrease in serum transaminases.
I think you made this point, but if somebody gets sort of incident hep A on top of chronic hep B, especially if they're surface antigen positive, what's the relative increase in mortality from that?
Huge increase. That's the situation we call an acute on chronic hepatitis. We see it B on C, A on B and C, and the mortality in those patients probably goes up at least tenfold.
Okay. This is a question about general treatment for co-infected, meaning HBV, HIV co-infected. One patient's on a tenofovir regimen, fine. The other one's on an abacavir, but also gets entecavir. And both of them have had HBV viral loads that were controlled. Do you do anything more than this or just continue as they are? Are HBV genotypes, or are they pan-sensitive, I guess, is the question.
You do not need to do the genotyping on those patients. In fact, if they're controlled, you can't because that's measured in the HBV DNA. So if they're suppressed, you're fine.
We'll go to the microphones here. Oh, here first.
For the new cases of virulent hepatitis A outbreak happening in the whole country and some people dying with fulminant, is anybody trying to look to find out if this is a new strain of hepatitis A or there have been a mutation in the one that we know and now we have become more virulent?
Yeah. So there has been typing done, and there's several different circulating strains that are present. Some appear to be from Central and South America, and there have been some reports of Middle Eastern strains brought into the country.
And if that is the case, is the vaccines that we have will prevent, you know, people who are not
immune?
Yes,
the vaccines are very effective, but there's a large cohort of the population that is not vaccinated. So if you're over 70 years old, you probably have natural immunity because of the status across the country of sanitation systems when you were a child. If you were born in the last 10 years, you were probably vaccinated as a child. Everyone in between, very few have been vaccinated or exposed. So those patients are all at risk, which is part of why we've seen this huge outbreaks.
Right. We're out of time. If this could be very fast, like 15 seconds.
Yes, I think so. We'd been using a hepatitis panel to check for A, B, and C. Recently discovered that the hepatitis B can be negative, but if you check the titer, they're immune. It's over 10, even though on the general panel it said that they were negative. So we've started checking a titer for B. Do we need to do the same for A in light of all the new hepatitis A that's out there?
So I'm guessing that you need to talk to your laboratory because what's happened is that the manufacturers, particularly Abbott, that makes many of the tests, has recommended an indeterminate or intermediate range that goes from like 7 to 11. Like, well, don't expect us to tell you if you're immune or not, so we'll just give you a range, and then that gets reported by your lab as negative in the indeterminate range, and then you do a quant and it's 11, and that's protective. So that's why you're getting that. The Hep A is a little bit less clear. We actually don't have enough long-term prospective studies where people have lost antibody to know if people in high-risk situations, including these outbreaks, if they've lost antibody, need boosters. And so there's no formal CDC recommendation for boosters. The data are actually mixed. There was evidence of new infections that occurred in some places with 5 and 10 year follow-up in high-risk areas. But they were asymptomatic, as most are, and so people said, oh, it doesn't mean anything. So, I mean, if you're in an outbreak area and you test and it's negative, I would just revaccinate that patient.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Ken. Great review. So, to continue all of these discussions for the day, I'll just employ the phrase, get a room. So, your room is up here on the board, and so whatever you want to get a room to do or talk more about, these are the rooms that you go to today. I think everybody has an assignment. Thanks to the speakers. Thanks to all of you for your great participation today. And after the workshops, you're done and can go back out to the Ferris wheel. We'll see you tomorrow morning.